Fine. So what we're going to be doing today is something of an introductory approach to the origins and formations of the Gemara. We always talk a lot about the Gemara. The Gemara says this, the Gemara says this. Chazal say this, Chazal say that. It's important to get some clear terms straight in our head so we know who we're talking about, what we're talking about when these things are said. Just to recap on Shir number 15, which is what we did last, Shir number 15 talks about the origins and formation of the Mishnah. And just to give you a time frame, the Mishnah was put together in around the year 200 CE. And it was put together as a result of, and this is Shir in 14, 13, 12, etc., a result of a shift, a change of paradigm at the end of the Second Temple period, where we basically, the systems that we had in place for making sure the oral law worked right, broke down significantly. Those systems primarily were the Sanhedrin, the group of 71 Torah sages at the head of the tree, the top of the tree, that ultimately decided everything one way or the other, so there was no machloket at the end of the day, because everything, there was no debate, dispute, everything could be decided one way or the other, so you didn't have Rabbi so-and-so says this, Rabbi so-and-so says this. The Rambam explained that this, as I say, goes back to Shir 12-13, that when the Sanhedrin really broke down, and the people went into exile, and then the temple was destroyed, and the general disruption, what you had is a proliferation of different ways of looking at it, and also the removal of the system to remove the ultimate debate. So you ended up with a system where lots of rabbis said lots of things. Now, again, not everybody's arguing about everything. It's a big misnomer in Judaism that, oh, everyone's arguing about everything, no rabbis agree on anything. That's ridiculous. There's vast amounts of Judaism that everybody agrees on, okay? The details, are enormous, and therefore the disagreement is substantial, but the disagreement began to expand, and the Mishnah was a result of a consolidation of that period in the time of someone called Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi. He basically, what he did in the 3rd century, end of the 2nd, 3rd century, he took all of the information that existed, he condensed it into 6 books. This was the Mishnah, this was last time Shir. 6 books where he reorganized, he put together a completely new system of organization for the oral law, and now instead of a vast, amorphous mass of oral law with lots of different opinions, and he didn't just start this, he was building on other things that already started, which again we discussed last time, we ended up with something called the Mishnah. Mishnah, the done deal, 6 books, you can look at sheet 15 to look at the structure and what it includes, etc., etc. Now we have a Mishnah. But what we have is something which is A, extremely condensed, therefore it doesn't really make a lot of sense. It's almost like incredibly strong orange juice that you can't actually drink without watering it down a little bit. So what you have is this enormous, vast oral law is condensed into this tiny little book. Okay? Tiny. It's not actually tiny. It's really quite big. There are thousands and thousands of Mishnayot. I actually put down somewhere on sheet 15. Oh, sheet 15. I'm going to sheet 15 for a second. Here. Oh, no, I didn't list how many there were. Sorry. I did, or did? No. But there are at least 4,000 or 5,000 Mishnayot. But basically, they are extremely difficult to learn without any commentary. Because there was no written commentary, what there was is still this large body of oral law which remained oral around it. Okay? And that was the status quo at that period. Historically, what's going on here is as follows. The Jewish community in Eretz Israel was under incredible pressure. Shortly after the Mishnah was put together, and the reason they put it together is because they were frightened this might happen, or something like this might happen, and it did happen. The Roman Empire clamped down even more strongly on the Jewish community here in Eretz Israel because the Romans turned Christian. When the Romans were Roman, their antagonism towards the Jews was more or less political. We don't want a revolution, we don't want them throwing off Roman rule, etc. When the Romans became Christian, so their antagonism became religious and theological. And therefore the Jewish communities in Eretz Israel quickly found it extremely difficult to survive, and the center of gravity shifted to the east, to the northeast, to the communities in Babel. Now, there were always Jews living in Babel through the whole Second Temple period. After the first exile in the First Temple, you can see here on the sheet here, the First Temple was exiled here. Jews exiled to Babylonia in 510, 503, that kind of stuff. So this is BCE. So there'd been Jews already in Babylon for hundreds and hundreds of years, but the shift of the community back to Babylon was very pronounced at this time. Many of the rabbis had to leave, many of the communities packed up and basically left Eretz Israel. What you had, therefore, is a realization that this system, where you have this tiny little condensed form of a text,
not necessarily even written, but a text, and this oral law around it, that was not going to work anymore. There was too much disruption even for that. So what they did is they expanded this thing in the middle, and instead of the Mishnah, or as well as the Mishnah, I should say, you now have a much bigger text. And not much bigger, but vastly bigger text. And what they did, and we'll see in a minute, we'll see the source inside, at around 500 CE in Babel, they took lots of the discussion, the commentary, the opinions that had grown up around the Mishnah, and they put it into a new text called the Gemara. This is what we call the Talmud Bavli, Babylonian Talmud. There had been an attempt to do this before in Israel, called the Talmud Yerushalmi. It's called the Talmud Yerushalmi because it was written in Israel. It wasn't actually written in Yerushalayim. The Jews didn't live in Yerushalayim. The Jews mostly lived in the north, in the Galil. It was called the Talmud Yerushalmi out of Kavod, out of honor to Yerushalayim. But there is another Talmud that was written before the main one, called the Talmud Yerushalmi. That was never really completely finished. It was never fully edited. The pressure on the communities was so much that it was left sort of 80% done, if you like, or I don't know the exact percentage, but something like that. And therefore, once the Talmud Bavli took over, it took into account the Yerushalmi, knew about it, and therefore, generally speaking, when there is a debate or a dispute between the two Talmuds, the Babylonian Talmud wins, because it's more complete, it's later, it's more thoroughly edited, it's more comprehensively put together. Yes?
What's all that last chunk?
Oh, it's because the picture doesn't stop there. Because the oral law that's still oral remained, if you like, what you need to know to understand the Gemara. How do you get to know that? You ask your rabbi. We'll see, when we get there, in the next couple of shiurim after this, Be'ezrat Hashem, that again, over time, it was spelled that that was not enough. And therefore, when the Gemara itself became a written text, definitely a written, there began to be commentaries around the outside of the Gemara, which is then an expansion of this written text into here. So now you have even more written, and then even more written, and that's going on ad hayom hazeh, to this very day. When the Art Scroll publishing house decided to publish in the late 80s, early 90s, their Art Scroll English Gemara series, so they were doing a massive new going like this, presenting to the English public a written commentary on the Gemara, which enabled that to be accessible by more and more people who couldn't access it before, and that's an ongoing thing. Now there's not so much left oral. There's still some stuff left oral. There's still some stuff if you want to know what to do. And at the end of the day, the methodology of learning Gemara is oral. Yeah. In a sense that you can't just learn from the book itself how to learn the book itself. You have to go to somebody to teach you how to learn Gemara. It's a skill. But that's the same with every skill. You know, you can't learn how to be a doctor by reading medical books. You'll read all the books and you'll learn all the medicine and then you'll go work in a hospital. And then they'll teach you how really to be, you're a doctor. It's the same being a lawyer or anything else. So let's have a look at the source sheet now, source number 1 on sheet 16, and then we will have a look at how the Gemara really came about. Tana Rabbanan. So the Gemara here makes a very interesting statement. Ha'oitzkin b'mikra, midah ve'enu midah. Somebody who wants to spend their time learning mikra, which means Tanakh, the written law. Okay? It says, source number 1, sheet 16. Okay? It's good, but it's not that good. In other words, there are downsides to spending all your time learning Tanakh. There are things that you're going to be missing out. That doesn't mean, of course, we necessarily swing to the opposite extreme. The Gemara also has some negative things to say about people who never learn Tanakh. But okay, midah ve'en midah, it's kind of qualified thumbs up. The Mishnah, somebody who learns Mishnah, which is what we just talked about before, midah, it's good, but not le'alaskar, and you get a good reward for that. That's a step up. But Talmud, but if you learn Talmud, and the word Talmud and the word Gemara, for our purposes, are interchangeable. We always used to call it Talmud. The church, for various reasons, got a bit upset with us. They didn't like the word Talmud, and they were very angry with Talmud. The church really vented a lot of historical antagonism towards the Talmud and edited the Talmud and censored the Talmud. The Talmuds we have on our shelves today are the censored, church-censored versions. Don't worry, we have the originals in manuscripts and we know what was censored, and it wasn't that much. But the church were very upset and they made us call it Gemara for various reasons. But it used the terms interchangeably for now. But Talmud, if you want to learn Talmud, Ein lecha midah gedola mizoi. This is the best of the best of the best. Okay, very nice. But that's quite a strong statement. The Gemara wants to know, who said that? Well, why is this so stressed?
Amar Rabbi Yochanan b'mei Rabbi Nishneis Mishnazu. This particular teaching, Mishnah here doesn't mean necessarily Dafka, specifically a Mishnah from the Mishnayos, but this teaching was said at the time of Rebbe. Rebbe is the person who put together the Mishnah, the book of the Mishnah. What happened then? Shavku kula alma masnisin. Everybody stopped doing Mishnah. The Azla Basa Talmud, and everyone started doing Talmud. What did that mean? It was kind of a shift, another paradigm shift of approach, that what had been, the way people had been learning Torah up until this point, shifted and they started doing something a little bit different. What did they start doing and what did they stop doing? And this is an important thing to learn. The Gemara in another place, and this hopefully will be clear in a few minutes, the Gemara in another place, number two, says, Rebbe be Rebbe Nosson Sof Mishnah. Rebbe, who we just mentioned, this word Rebbe, they called him Rebbe because he was the rabbi. The rabbi, Rebbe Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Judah the Prince, he was the one who put together the Mishnah. Rebbe be Rebbe Nosson, his Rabbi Nosson, his colleague, Sof Mishnah. That was the end of the Mishnah, 200 CE. Rav Ashi, Ravina, Rav Ashi and Ravinu, Sof Horah. They were the end of the teaching, which here is pretty much synonymous with the end of the Talmud. And Rashi, on this particular Gemara, wants to know, what exactly does this mean? So have a look at number three. This is Rashi, and I'll explain this Rashi, and hopefully we'll get a good idea for what the Gemara is for. Sof Mishnah. Sof Tanaim, and you have to just remember these terms. The rabbis of the Mishnah are called the Tanaim. The word Tana comes from the word in Aramaic, to teach. It comes from Shana, okay, in Hebrew. Very often in Hebrew, Shin turns to Ta, into Aramaic. Okay, very often words in Hebrew which have Shins have Tas in Aramaic. For example, Shalosh. I can't use pen with that word. Yeah. Shalosh, okay, in Aramaic is Talat. You can see that very clearly. Okay, so Tana, and Aleph often goes, this comes from a Hay in Hebrew. So Shana comes from, goes into Tana. Shana, of course, is the word Mishnah, teaching. From the word in the Shema, Vashinantam Levanecha. You will teach them to your children. It implies repetition. Okay, repetition. Because the Mishnah, again, was more like a memorized, condensed form of the oral law that people could learn and learn and learn and learn and learn. Says Rashi, Sof Mishnah. Sof Tanaim, the end of the Tanaim. Ad Yemehem, up until the time of the Mishnah, Amru Ishes Dvarav Beveis Medrash. Each person would say his, each rabbi would say his view in the Bet Midrash, in the study house. Bahayu Talmidim Gorisin Shmuel Shmuel Levada. And all the Talmidim would learn what that rabbi said. Can you imagine Rabbi Akiva's Bet Midrash would learn Rabbi Akiva's Mishnahs. And Rabbi Yeshua's would learn Rabbi Yeshua's. Rabbi Lezer's would learn Rabbi Lezer's. Everyone have their own. Veloi Hayu Masechtas Sidurus. There wasn't like an order, a specific order to all the, this kind of subject goes here and this kind of subject goes there. V'sider, v'kibes ala seder, what they did is that the Rebbe and Rebbe Nosson ordered the Mishnah, like we said before. They took everything that was said in the previous generations. V'sidrai ala masechtas. Masechta is the word for a volume of the Mishnah. They put it into masechtas. V'achreihem, this is very important, Rashi. V'achreihem lo yosifu ala ma'at. There was very little added after the Mishnah. Now that's a very fascinating statement, because the Mishnah is a book this thin, and the Talmud is like this, and if you add in all this other stuff, the commentaries on the Talmud, and the commentaries on the commentaries, and the super commentaries on the super commentaries, on the super commentaries, you now walk into a yeshiva library, and it's like tens and hundreds of thousands of svarim, and the Mishnah is just like, so what does Rashi mean? After the Mishnah, very little was added. So what he means is, not just in volume, of course in volume vast amounts was added, but in terms of the principles of Jewish law, the principles of halakha, are almost all in the Mishnah. What comes after the Mishnah is clarification, application to different cases, discussion, what are the reasons behind them, what are the fundamental, you know, principles underlying the basic rules of Jewish law. But really, if you want to know where do we source now all our Jewish laws, they're in the Mishnah. They're all in the Mishnah. Very little new is added in the Gemara in terms of new ideas, principles. Which is fascinating because it means that everything we do in Judaism is really very old. It's not just kind of recent, made up. Minhagim. Minhagim, by their very nature, are fluid. And they change over time. And therefore, some of the things that we do as minhagim are relatively new, and some of them have changed over the last few hundred years, but that's the nature of minhagim. If you are able to strip aside all the minhagim, and sometimes that's hard to do, you know, when you go to a Sephardi shul and you go to an Ashkenazi shul, it's tempting to feel that you're on two different planets. Because, you know, this looks like this, and look, most of what you feel is alien, if you're one or the other and you go to the other, most of what you feel is alien is minhag. They sing it this way, they sing it that way. They have these pictures on the wall, they have these pictures on the wall. They have this accent, they have this accent. When you actually strip it down, look at the service, it's the same. It's the same service. Okay, they do this in this order, and they do this in a slightly different order. But they all have basically the same Shemana Esrei, the same Shemara, and the same Brachot, etc., etc. And it's 99% identical. And that's why sometimes we feel incorrectly when it comes to halakha. Oh, I don't know, Rabbi, everybody's doing different things. Everybody's, where can you get? The answer is because you're not looking at the actual halakha that people are keeping. Everyone's got the same fleishiks and milchiks and the real halachic issues are all really there in the Mishnah. That's a very important point to learn. So, fine, that's the Mishnah. Then what about the Gemara? So the next bit of Rashi, number 3, Sophara, the end of the Talmud, the end of ruling. So Hara means literally ruling. Sof kol ha'amorayim. And this is another word you need to learn. You just need to remember this. Amorayim. Now there comes a point in life when you have to actually make a decision to never forget these words ever again. That is just a conscious decision. We're in the middle of Sof 3. You just, because, you know what it is? You can hear somebody say these 1,000 times, and 1,000 times you hear them, and 1,000 times you forget them. Okay. So we are in the middle of Source 3, where it says involved Sof Hara'ah. Yeah? Sof Amorai. Again, just remember these right. Ta Na Yim are the rabbis of the Mishnah. And Amorayim are the rabbis of the Gemara. It's really not complicated. Many of you have MAs and PhDs and who knows what and all sorts of stuff. You can remember this, I promise you. Okay? The rabbis of the Mishnah, the rabbis of the Gemara, Tanaim and Amorayim. Here's an equation. Tanaim plus Amorayim equals Chazal. Okay? When people talk about Chazal, the Chachamim, the Chronim of Racha, that's who they're talking about. They're not talking about rabbis before the Tanaim, they're not talking about David HaMelech, and they're not talking about people after, they're talking about Rashi, the Rambam. Chazal basically means this group of people.
The one says Amor.
Amorahim.
Right. When does the
think of Amor as in love.
When does the Tanaim start?
That's an interesting question. It doesn't have a very clear start date like it has a clear end date. It makes most sense to start it probably around Hillel and Shammai. Although the truth is the rabbis of the Mishnah do quote from before them. They quote really from the end of the Anshei Knesset Agudah. The earliest start date you can put in is the beginning of the Second Temple. It's a bit fuzzy at the beginning. Hillel and Shammai is the latest start date. And you can pick a start date somewhere in between. Okay? Now, see what Rashi says. I'm on the fourth line of source number 3. Sof Hara, Sof Kol Amorayim. Ajimehem loy haita gemara ala seder. Until their time, we're talking about 5th century, there was no organized gemara. But what happened? But when a question was asked, betama mishnah, as to what did the mishnah mean? Again, this mishnah, this condensed summary of oral law, and people asked, what did that mean? What did that mean? But based on Medrash, and they asked on the Beit Midrash, or, says Rashi, she'ela al maaseh amoreah. There was a question as to something that happened, like a shaila that came up. I dropped my fleishiks and my milchiks and my milchiks and my paras, and what should I do? Bedin, mamon, in monetary matters, or itza v'hetza, or things which are permitted and prohibited, like kashrut or whatever. Kol echad v'echad ometamo. Each rabbi would say what they thought. I think the Mishnah means this, I think the Mishnah means that, and each, if you like, school of thought would develop. But Rav Ashi v'Ravina, what did Rav Ashi and Ravina do in the 5th century? They did the following. Sidro Shemuas Amorayim Shalifnehim. They organized again. It was an organizing. It was an editing job. They organized all of the statements of the Amorayim in front of them. The Kavu, and they fixed them al Seda Masechtas called Echad VeEchol Es and the Mishnah Arui VaShnuyelat. And they put them into the Mishnah together with all the Mishnahs that best fitted them. What do I mean by this? Imagine the Mishnah just as a list of Mishnayot 1 through to 5,000. Let's say. So, obviously, if there's a discussion about what a Mishnah meant, so Rav Ashi wrote up that discussion and then slotted it in near that Mishnah or on that Mishnah. And he wrote the parameters of that discussion and he wrote it up as, it's like an onion, okay? He wrote it up as different parallel layers of discussion.
But he wasn't just recording what people said. He had like, say, 300 years of like information in front of him, from the Mishnah up until then. He decided how to present that, and not just him, but it was a 60-year project with his whole academy. They decided how to present that and write it down in the Gemara. And now you have different rabbis arguing with each other in the Gemara in a very organized way. Indeed, if you're aware of the historical, if the historicity of the Talmud, if you like, then sometimes you'll be aware that rabbis are arguing with other rabbis in the Talmud that lived 200 years earlier. And you think to yourself, well, how did that happen? And the answer is, we're not just recording minutes of the discussions in the Beit Midrash, we're presenting the arguments in the names of the rabbis who are most famous for these arguments. And yes, sometimes, you know, that's famous. You might say, for example, now, Descartes argues with Hume on the following issues. But Descartes and Hume were not living at the same time as each other. So how could Descartes have an argument with Hume? No, that's not what I mean. You know what I mean. It's that Descartes says this, Hume says this, so they argue on each other. It's the same kind of idea. Now, let's just go on in Rashi a little bit. The Hikshu, on the end of the third line of that little bit, the Hikshu Kushyas, and he asked new kashyas. In other words, there's a narrator's voice in the Gemara, the voice of Rav Ashi. He doesn't say it like me. Hello, I have a question. He says, but what about this? But what about that? How about this? What about that? Okay? Sheyesh lahashiv upirgum, and he answers them, sheirum letarei teima v'raim sheimahem. V'kavu hakol b'gemara. And they fixed everything in the Gemara. And of course they did more than that. Because when they had all of this oral law they wanted to slot in, they said, oh wow, now that we're writing a book, let's write a really gewaltig book. Let's write a really gesunter, safer, and let's include in this not just the discussion about the Mishnah, but all sorts of stuff. Let's include help advice and marriage advice. Let's include agadic midrashim about things. And again, Rav Ashi had to make a decision, like an editorial decision. Which bit of the Mishnah shall I slip those into? Shall I put it here? Shall I put it there? And he wove together this absolutely fantastic book, which we now call the Gemara. It is, at the end of the day, the repository of Jewish law. That's where we get everything from. Halakha today does not work the way it worked 3,000 years ago, or even 2,000 years ago. 2,000 years ago, people were looking in the Chumash, they were trying to work out what it means, they were passing down things from Sinai, they were making new rabbinic law. None of this happens today. What's happened for the last 1,500 years is, we look at the Talmud. We're trying to work out what it says. Okay? And the Talmud also brought in stuff that Rabbi Yehuda Anasi left out of the Mishnah. Because he had to condense it, he had to leave material out. The Gemara brings some of that back and says, oh, but what about this? How does this contrast? And why did he leave this out? And how do we understand this? And how do they fit together? That's what basically he did. And therefore, when you learn the Gemara today, it's not just enough to read the words or even to translate them. The hard part about learning Gemara is not the translation, it's not the linguistic stuff. You can master the language quite quickly. You know, most of it's in Hebrew, by the way, not Aramaic. I don't know the percentage, but I wouldn't be surprised if 60 to 70% of the Gemara is actually in completely understandable Hebrew, which is why Israelis, when they come to learn Gemara, they open up the book of the Gemara and they think, well, I already understand 55 to 60% of this page because it's in Hebrew. Okay? The Aramaic is usually easy to get used to. That's not the hard part of the Gemara. The hard part of the Gemara is learning how to read the road signs. One of my Gemara Rebbe's used to tell me that there were road signs in the Gemara. Each of the conjunctions and the words and the introductions to the questions meant something slightly different. Amar Rava and Ravar Amar are two different statements. Well, they both mean Rava said, but one of them is said as a question or as a response, and one of them is said as a new topic. In other words, once you learn to read very, very carefully, and we don't read carefully today, One of the rules that you'll think, skills that you'll pick up being in Midrashah, hopefully, is the ability to actually read and read what you're reading, rather than read what you think you're reading, which often is what people do. As a lawyer, by the way, you get trained to do this as well. A lawyer, you get trained, don't just read what it says, read what it really says, okay? And think about what it might mean, and that's how you end up making hundreds of thousands of dollars trying to make things that mean things that people didn't think they meant, when actually they may mean that. So the Gemara is difficult because you have to learn those skills. But once you learn them, it's brilliant. And it's very logical. It's very daunting for a high school student. They look, this is massive Aramaic and Hebrew. But once you've found your way around,
You know, it's like a warm slipper. You know, you can slip into it and feel at home. Yes.
Actually, from which age do they teach Gemara?
That's a good question. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos says the ideal, as far as they were concerned, order for teaching boys. They weren't really teaching girls Torah, but let's leave the issue of boys and girls aside. Let's say boys. Torah is at 5 you learn Chumash, at 10 you learn Mishnah, and at 15 you learn Gemara. Now, why is that? Because Chumash is the basis of everything, the Pesukim, to have a complete understanding of Tanakh. So you do 5 years on that. Then at 10 you start learning the sort of data upload of the Mishnah to learn off by heart. You know, and these kids, by the way, do this. 10, 11, 12-year-olds, they learn Mishnayos and hundreds and thousands of Mishnayos. And then at 15, when your brain is already beginning to mature, you start to learn the analytical back and forth and pull it apart and deconstruct and reconstruct and that. Now, we don't tend to do it this way these days. There is one school of thought, what they call the Zildman method, where they, in a certain Chadarim, where they really do it this way. But most of the Chadarim and the schools across America and England or whatever, they start the Gemara much earlier and the Mishnayos much earlier. Kids are learning Mishnayos at 7 and 8 and they're learning Gemara at 12 and 13. And it's a good question as to whether that's right, whether that's wrong, but listen, that's not the only question in education as to whether it's right or wrong. It's one of a number of educational, you know, dilemmas. When do I start learning Gemara? If I start too late, the kids won't know enough by the time they get to the Yeshiva Gevoah at 18 and they'll all be behind. If I start too early, the kids don't understand it, they get upset with it, get bored, get lost, and then they don't like Gemara. The world is full of people who have been taught Gemara badly and now they know they don't like Gemara. This is one of the big dilemmas in teaching women Gemara in high schools, in modern Orthodox high schools. If you're going to teach it badly, then you're not doing any favours. So instead of having half the population that hate Gemara, now you have the whole population that hate Gemara. Mm-hmm. I'm being a bit cynical and I'm being a bit negative. You can of course teach it well, in which case you have everybody that loves Gemara, which is different, which is great. It's a kind of like maths, right? Mm-hmm. Right. It's true. You had a question? Or you asked
a
question?
The second part. Because, yes. Actually, to me, it's very difficult to understand how men learn. I have friends, I have a friend who learned Gemara. So, I was in being alone before. So
okay. Okay, yeah, sure. Sure.
The point is, for example, when we talk about the group of the 18. In the Yeshiva Vlog in the Rav Kook that
yes.
Learned 60 pages of Gemara. What does it mean in fact? Oh, 60 pages, okay, he reads 60 pages. I can't relate what it really means.
I can't describe it to you unless you do it. It's like I could spend 10 years describing what Shabbat's like. If you actually spend Shabbat somewhere, you'll learn a lot more about what Shabbat's like than if I describe it to you. It's the same with learning, it's experiential. Learning Gemara doesn't happen in a vacuum. You take some completely, a guy with completely no background and give him an English Gemara when he's 25 years old, he won't understand what learning Gemara is. It has to be, you know, you can be trained, you can do it. By the way, there's a slight advantage in my humble opinion to actually coming to Gemara a bit later as a Baal Tshuva. They have disadvantages and advantages. The disadvantage is they're way behind and they're playing catch up on all these kids who are 10 years younger than them, know 20 times more than them. On the other hand, they're coming to it with a structured brain that understands how to analyse and can therefore grasp the structure much more. Most kids learn by osmosis, you know? They know what it means. It's a bit like the way you speak English. My kid's in, you know, high school here and he's an English speaker. And the Israelis who are learning English, they come up to him and they say, is this sentence the subconjunctive with the predicate subject-object combination? And he says, I don't know, but it doesn't sound right. Yeah? And they say, well, what should it be? So he writes what it should be. He says, oh, well, how does that differ? He says, well, I don't know, but that sounds right now. It's a bit like that. So guys who learn Gemara from, you know, age whatever, so they kind of know what it means, but they don't know why they know what it means. That's not so great, actually, because it's much... The people who really learn well know how to really break it down and put it together again, and therefore if you go to Chappelle's or somewhere like that, you're probably likely to get a much better education in Gemara than half of the guys that went to high school because of the nature of the people there teaching and the nature of the people who go there. But the question, what does it mean to learn 60 pages of Gemara? It's also a question of familiarity. When's the last time that you read the same thing 100 times, one after the other?
No.
Did you ever do that?
No.
It would be boring after the second time, right? You just wouldn't do it. you have to adjust yourself to understanding that when you learn something once, twice, three, four times, you didn't learn it yet. You have to do it again and again and again and again and again. And the 101st time is better than the 100th. Therefore, once you've learned a Daf Gemara hundreds and hundreds of times, you can take a Daf Gemara that other people might spend weeks and weeks trying to deconstruct, and you can go through it, and you can learn it in 5 minutes. And as you're learning, you're not just laning it, you're not just like, you know, reading it and not knowing what you're saying. You're reading it, and as you're reading the words, all the information is flooding back into your brain. Do you know how clever your brain is? It can do an awful lot. Think of how many things you think every second without even know you're thinking them. So if that thinking was in Gemara, so you can learn very quickly. The Vilna Gaon used to do Chazara on the whole of Masechet Shabbos in Gemara every Shabbos, which is like 160 daf, something like that. But he'd learnt it so many times, he probably spent like 90 seconds on a daf. Yeah? One of my teachers wants to ask Rav Chaim Kanievsky in Bnei Brak a question where a particular Gemara came from. So Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, or particular statements of the Chazal. So Rav Chaim Kanievsky said, aha. And he walks up and down, and he's going around, and as he's walking up and down, he's saying, it's not in Yerushalmi. Yeah, this is not in Babli. And it's going through, it's like a CD-ROM going. People really do that. People can do that. You have to be very gifted, and you have to be very hardworking. Being gifted without being hardworking doesn't work, and being hardworking without being gifted is very hard. Although you can sometimes make yourself gifted, it's interesting. But hard work is essential, and that's why they learn long, 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 long hours. We're talking about 14, 15 hour days learning Gemara. Now, I'm not saying that the best way to structure the Jewish community is for everybody to do that for the whole of their lives. I'm not having that discussion. But I'm saying, in order to learn how to learn Gemara, you can't, and it's a bit of a joke, you know, you go to school and say, oh, we learned Gemara. What's that then? You had like half an hour a week in like methodology in Gemara. It's better than nothing, I'm not doing it down. But you didn't learn Gemara. Do me a favor, you didn't learn Gemara. You learned 4, 5, 7, 9 hours a day for 4 years? Okay. We can start talking. We can start talking whether you know how to know Gemara. But without that kind of investment of time, it's like saying, you know, I can be a doctor. I went online and I read a few things. Look, I know what to do. No, you're not operating on me, mate. Yes. Yes, let's talk about this now. So, yes.
So, this is Dafyom. This time, if you learn everything, then in 7 years, you can finish.
Right, let's talk. Let me answer your question. What does Dafyom mean? So, the Gemara, if you look at the quick facts I brought you on page 3. Talmud Bavli, quick facts. Okay? This will answer your question. First of all, you should know, and it makes a lot of sense to know this, that not all of the Mishnah has a Gemara on it. When Rav Ashi decided to write the Gemara, he just left some of the Mishnah uncommented on. Why? Because there are parts of the Mishnah that just didn't apply anymore. For example, most of the Mishnahs that deal with the agricultural laws of Eretz Israel have no Gemara on them. So not Babli, they have some Yerushalmi, because in Babel there's no Shemitah, in Babel there's no Trumas and Maestros, there's none of the Tithes, there's none of that, there's no Challah and all that. Not the Darabon, all there is, but so they didn't have that. Similarly, all the Tumah and Tahara that we talked about last Thursday, all of those laws of Tumah and Tahara, there's no Gemara directly on those Mishnahs. There are discussions in the Gemara about Tumah and Tahara, but they're in other places. Okay? So quite a lot of the Mishnah never got any Gemara on it. Interestingly, Kodshim, that deals with the Korbanot, the sacrifices, did get an entire section of Gemara on it. And everyone's asking, what? Why? I mean, they were just like there were no agricultural laws in Babel, 500 years after the temple was destroyed, so there were no sacrifices either. So what's the point of writing books and books and books about sacrifices that aren't happening anymore? Well, you're planning to go back to Eretz Israel as well, so write Shemitah too. That's not an answer. You're planning to have Tumah and Tahara again, so keep it alive. They obviously didn't think that for the other thing, so why did they think that for this? It seems that the answer is that with Korbanot, and we see this midrashically as well, if you can't bring a Korban, learning about bringing the Korban is a substitution. Because at the end of the day, it's the mental space, it's the mental leap that is the real sacrifice. The animal is just, if you like, a means to an end. So learning about Korbanos is not the same, but it's a substitute. Whereas learning about, Shemitah year, there's no idea that if you learn about Shemitah year, it's as if you had Shemitah year. No. If you don't have it, you don't have it. If you're living in Brooklyn, you don't have it, finished. You can learn, it's nice, it's Talmud Torah, but it's nothing to do with Shemitah. It's the Mitzvah Talmud Torah. So anyway, so there's basically, I put here 5,422 pages, which is 2,711 daf. Blat. A blat is the Yiddish word for a daf. Okay? Now, so what is Dafyomi? Dafyomi is something that started about 80, 90 years ago. Somebody, Rav Meir Shapiro in Lublin, decided that there would be a cycle of people learning one daf per day. One daf is basically two sides of Gemara. Okay? Gemara works in an A-B folio style. We don't tend to have books like this. We tend to have books that go with numbers from one to whatever. The Gemara starts at number two, for some reason which is not entirely clear, but it starts on daf bet, and it's 2A, 2B, 3A, 3B, 4A, 4B, 5A, 5B. That's how it works. So learning an A-B, okay, is a daf. And if you do one of those, 2,711 daf every day, so then you'll finish the entire Talmud Bavli in 7.5 years. Now, you didn't learn the entire Torah by a long way, because there's all the other Mishnayos, and there's all the other commentaries, and there's a limited amount of what you can do in Daf Yomi. Think about it. Daf Yomi is like the open-top bus tour around the Gemara. Meaning, you go to a new place. You go to Budapest.
Yeah.
Okay? I'm an American tourist.
Yeah.
I'm not really. But I'm an English tourist, which is possible. And I go to Budapest, and I don't know the first thing about Budapest. And I pick up a guidebook, and I look in the guidebook, and it says, take the open-top bus tour around Budapest. You get on a bus, tourist bus, and you pick one of those things, and they say, you know, and you go around for about, you know, like a hop-on, hop-on.
Yeah, but it's only in the first...
One second. So you're going around, and they say, on your right, it's the Royal Palace. And everyone's looking around. By the time you looked around, you've already gone around the corner. What was that? Was that the Royal Palace? I don't know. I think that was a court of justice. I'm not sure. That's what you do. And you go. And when you finish the bus tour, you say, "Oh, I know Budapest now." And the answer is, yeah. You know where to find things. So that if you ever want to go in, you know where it is. That's the same with Daf Yomi. Daf Yomi is basically you go quickly through the Gemara. You get a feel for where everything is. But how much can you really do in an hour? Doing two sides of Gemara in an hour is a very tough order. You need a very good shiur giver who can summarize, and you need to make sure there are no nudniks in the class who are going to distract and completely derail the class. You've got to finish the daf in an hour. Because you have to do it in an hour. You can do it in 4 hours, but no one's going to come to the shiur. Okay? And you can't fall behind, because tomorrow is another daf. To paraphrase the end of, what was it? Tomorrow is another day? Anyway, something gone with the wind, that's right. Tomorrow is another day. Tomorrow is another day.
If there's a child who is 13 years old, hearing is fantastic, and then everything, blah, blah, finishes when he is 20, it's okay. But when he starts again, from 20 until 27,
he'll do it better.
Upgrade.
Yeah, but that's not how we learn Gemara.
No?
Yeah, it's not good how we learn Gemara that way, because when you're 13, we don't do the Afyomi. Because when you're 13, you have to learn how to learn. And therefore you take much longer. If you go to a yeshiva, like a high-level yeshiva, let's say for 18, 19-year-olds, how long will it take them to do a daf Gemara? So the answer is, if they're learning bi'iyun, meaning in-depth, and they're learning every day, it could take them weeks, 5-6 weeks, they're learning 4 hours a day to get through one daf Gemara, which the daf Yomishe does in an hour.
Why
do they spend so long, or why did the Daf Yomi do it so quick?
Why does it take so long?
Because the Gemara has an enormous amount of commentary, and every line is very complex. And you have to look at how much depth you want to go in.
In Daf Yomi,
the guy presents the Daf according to one particular opinion as to how it works, because you just can't get into all the opinions, and he picks the opinion which is most readily graspable in a small amount of time, and you move on from there. If the people at the Daf Yomi Shir are more learned, you can start getting into more things. I know people who make the most of the Daf, and what they do is they do preparation with a Chavrutah in the morning, maybe in an hour, and they go to a Shir in the afternoon, and they do a Chazara in the evening. Wow, that's really great. But that's 3 hours a day. Not everybody has 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
You know, some people have what they have.
Didn't we
earn an
amazing?
What's that? We're going to have a look at something. It's not just how long we've got. Right. One second. It's what? It's a mixture of everything. It's principles. It's like statutes and case law and commentary and lectures. It's everything all rolled into one. Yeah. You want to learn? What? What are you looking at?
I don't.
Oh, okay. Well, what are you holding then? Oh, her. Right, fine. Okay, let's go. Shh. I want you to look, please. Your question, Kara, is Kara right?
Yeah, Kara. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Rachel. No problem. I'll call you whatever you wish to be called as long as it's decent. Right, fine. Let's have a look at page 4. And I want you to just see, I'm going to really quickly read this, because this is the Rambam. This is the Rambam's translated commentary. The Rambam wrote an introduction to the Mishnah, okay? In which he basically takes you through, the page looks like this, okay? Which he takes you through a different summary of what all these things are. So he said like this. Rav Ashi, someone else read this quickly. Someone who can read quickly and clearly. Yes, Danielle.
Rav Ashi devoted himself to composing the Gemara and decided to do with the words of all those who came after Rabbeinu HaKadosh. But Rabbeinu HaKadosh did with the words of all those who came after Moshe.
This is just like Rashi said. Just like Rebbe collected up all the statements and organized them into the Mishnah, similarly Rav Ashi organized everything since then and collected them into the Gemara.
He collected all the words of those spokesmen, the deliberations of the thinkers, the explanations of the commentators, and the legal interpretations. He gathered and mastered it all with the wisdom granted him by the Holy One, blessed be He, of a humble soul, and glory of wisdom, and he composed the Gemara. He intended to accomplish 4 goals.
Now listen carefully. These are the 4 goals of the Gemara.
To explain statements by the Mishnah, by A, recording the divergent opinions as to its intent, B, recording the arguments of each interpreter against his colleague, and C, recording the disclosure of the correct opinion.
So the first purpose of the Gemara is to make the Mishnah clear and understandable, and to take this highly concentrated part of oral law and make it actually learnable, drinkable, quotes for quotes, so that you can actually understand it.
What makes an opinion
correct? Oh, that's a good question. What makes an opinion correct is how in the end the halakha is decided. How do we know how the halakha is decided? So there are certain halachic rules. This rabbi against this rabbi usually wins, but not always. It depends on which area. It depends sometimes. One of the trickiest things about learning Gemara, and you're asking why does it take so long, is the Gemara doesn't usually finish each little section and have a drum roll and say, oh, the answer is this. It doesn't do that. You have to often tease out of the Gemara from the way it's structured, from the way it asks questions, what is the correct opinion. For example, if there are 2 opinions in the Gemara, and the Gemara suddenly starts asking questions on one of those opinions, but not the other. What does that indicate? The opinion on which it's asking questions, is that more likely to be the one that we do follow or the one that we don't follow? Why do you say that?
Because we didn't follow or they asked the question.
That's one way of looking at it. Which is the one that we're asking about is the one that we're most interested in. The other one is like irrelevant. On the other hand, you could say that the Gemara has the most problems with that one, and therefore it has the most difficulty understanding it. And what happened about this? And what about this? And what about this? And what about this? And what about this? You have to work out which of those approaches is the most appropriate given the context. There's a lot of context. By the way, Hebrew is very contextual. So the chief rabbi in one of his books pointed this out recently. I read recently. He wrote it quite recently. He said in English, he said that a word, because we write English with vowels, the word is very, it's a very atomized language. If I write the word cat, C-A-T, you don't need a sentence to understand what that word is. Because it makes sense in and of itself. Hebrew, by its very nature, and other Semitic languages too, but Hebrew specifically, because you don't write it with vowels, unless I show you the word in a context, you don't know what the word means. Because it could be vocalized in 10 different ways, which it means completely different things. Nachon? Think about the implications of that. It means that you cannot learn Hebrew, and therefore you cannot learn Judaism, unless you think contextually. That's what it's telling you. You have to look at a bigger picture, and you have to think, well, I know the word says that, but what does it mean in the context? That's a very, very different way of learning a language and learning a culture. And in fact, the chief rabbi goes on to make this is a bit speculative. He says he suggests this is why Hebrew is written from right to left, and English from left to right. Things that you do with your right brain are more likely to start in the right and go this way. Things you do with your left brain the other way. He says, we only started writing in Greek history from left to right with Greek philosophy. When Greek philosophy started, they first of all started going from right to left. Then they started the system of, you went from right to left and then down a line and left to right, then down a line and right to left. It went like that for a couple of hundred years. And then they just scrapped that and said, we're going from left to right. He says, writing from left to right is a certain way of thinking. And going from right to left is a different way of thinking. One of the problems we sometimes have with Judaism is we're just approaching it with Greek heads, and we don't even know how Greek our heads are. And Judaism just requires a lot more context. So maybe that's one of the things. I can't remember your question now. What was your question?
How do we know what's the correct
answer? What's the correct answer? The answer is context. Context is the answer. Okay. How does the Gemara say why? What kind of questions did it ask?
Yeah, but a lot of times they read just the Kasha.
No, a lot of times they don't actually. It's rare that they meet with a kasha. Most of the times they come to a conclusion. You don't have to recall what conclusion they've come to. And that's one of the jobs of the late authorities. Yes, Danielle, you're doing so well.
To record the final decision following the opinion of one of the two opponents in disagreement concerning the precise version of the Mishnah on its interpretation or on the new laws instituted by the Tanaim and included in the Mishnah.
Which is Psak Halacha. It has to Paskel Halacha. We don't Paskel Halacha from the Mishnah. It's too condensed. If you try and Paskel Halacha from the Mishnah, you will get the wrong end of the stick. Indeed, the Mishnah sometimes says the word and the halacha is, and it's not. Okay? So you need the Gemara to learn the halacha. Fine, carry on.
To record the two applications with the status of each generation derived from the Mishnah, including the basic underlying principles which the Tanaim of the Mishnah based itself upon, arranging them in the form that we have now, and also to record the additional Gezeros and Tachanot enacted since
right, the stuff that happened over the last 300 years was recorded in the Gemara, etc. And finally,
to record the guided drashas appropriate for the topic of each chapter within which they are now found.
And this is just a point I want to make. There are many, what you and I call midrashim. When we talk about midrashim, we're thinking about the stories, right? That's technically not the right word. The midrash just means something learned out from a verse in the Torah. It could be halachic or it could be non-halachic. The correct word for what you and I often call midrashim is agadah. The agadah is the story versions of the midrashim, if you like. And most of what we learn in the agadah, in the midrashim, midrashi agadah, is not in the Gemara. It's in separate books of the midrashim, which were composed later, about 200 or 300 years after the Gemara. However, the Gemara has certain midrashim in it, very famous ones often, which were included in the Gemara itself, and therefore they, if you like, have a slightly higher status. And they were recorded there as well. So that is the purpose and the function of the Gemara. I've just turned back for a second to page 3. We're not actually going to learn this Gemara this time. I want to start with the next time when you're fresher. Okay? But to start learning a page of Gemara at 25 past 6 when you've been in school all day is a tough business. I want you to have a fresh head. Okay? I just want to do two things with you. First of all, look at this sheet of Gemara that I've given you, just to give yourself a geographical orientation. This is a fairly random daf from the Gemara. Is it, which Masechta, which volume of the Gemara is it from?
Shabbat.
Shabbat, as it says on the top, clearly. From which chapter?
Shmini.
Right, it's the 8th going into the 9th. There's a chapter that starts at the bottom. But you see something very clearly from here. Yeah, the stuff in the middle here, obviously in the middle of the text, is the Gemara itself. All the stuff around the side, we haven't discussed what the stuff around the side is.
Okay.
But we'll get there eventually when we get there. It's Rashi and Tosafos in the standard Gemara, and all other things around the side as well. What you basically, if you look in the Gemara, there's large size fonts every now and then. It says Ms Memtaf, and then it says Gum. Yeah? They are Mishnah, Matznisin, which is Mishnah Aramaic, and Gemara. So this is basically a block of Mishnah, Gemara. A block of Mishnah, Gemara. Now, sometimes there's not that much Gemara on the Mishnah. You hear
the
Mishnah. No, that's in the Gemara. The Mishnah starts, this is a new Mishnah starts there.
Yeah.
And there's the Gemara, this Mishnah. See, the Gemara at the bottom of this block is only 5 or 6 lines long.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas sometimes it can be pages and pages and pages. Yes, all mixed together. So what you have now is a mixed thing. Now, the standard Gemara, and I'll finish with this idea. The standard Gemara that we use today, this one here, okay, it actually has English, in it as well. But the standard Gemara we use today is called the Vilna Shas. The Vilna Shas. Okay? Why is it called the Vilna Shas? And indeed, most times at the front page of the Gemara, it has, if it has a title page in this one. No, they just cut the title page out because it's in English as well. It says the Shas in Vilna. Why do we call it the Vilna Shas? Because it was printed in Vilna. The Gemara was printed pretty soon after the printing press was invented. There's an entire website dedicated to the printing of the Talmud. It's really interesting. It's got lots of interesting articles and discussions, quite academic. But the Gemara, the printing press was invented in the 1430s, 1439. And the first book in Hebrew to be printed was Chumash, with Rashi. And the Gemara was printed later. The Gemara was printed in the 1780s. There was a famous Shas printed called the Bomberg Shas, by a printer called Bomberg in Italy, I believe. Very famous because a version of the Bomberg Shas, a copy was given to Henry VIII. Remember Henry VIII with his six wives and all that stuff? And the history of the Bomberg Shas is really fascinating. There's a whole history. It now currently sits in Sotheby's. in New York, together with a collection of Sfarim, which is up for the highest bidder to be bought as a set. If you're interested and you've got a few hundred million dollars, then you can probably pick that up. But the Shas that we use today is not that one or the subsequent ones, it's the Vilna Shas. And people now are very, very wedded to their layout. Because if you think about it, the Daf Gemara are quite geometric. Some of them are sort of short and fat. Some of them are long and thin. Some of them have got little bits at the bottom. And therefore, one of the ways that you actually remember things from learning lots of Daf Gemara now is, oh, I don't exactly remember which page it is, but it's in a fat little bit at the bottom left-hand side. And therefore, if someone messes around with the pagination, then it throws everybody into disarray. That's one of the reasons why they do not put all the censored bits back into the Gemara. Because it'll mess around with all the pagination. You can find them in a different book. It's not hard to get them. But you can find them in a different book or at the back or somewhere like that. But now people, when they talk about Daf Yomi, it's on the Vilna Shas. Because the Vilna Shas has that number of Daf. It doesn't have to be that. When Rabbi Steinsaltz printed a new Gemara with a Hebrew, modern Hebrew translation or commentary, he rearranged the pagination. And everyone went absolutely mad. I mean, there were other reasons, hashkafically and politically, why they went mad as well. But one of the things they didn't like was his changing the layout. And therefore, when he reprinted his Gemara, he put it back in the Vilna Shas layout, with his commentaries and everything, but in the Vilna Shas layout. Therefore, people are very... The Gemara is very special to the Jews. It's our main text. That's why when the Christians were burning, trying to destroy Judaism, they burnt Talmuds. They didn't burn Bibles. They didn't even burn commentaries. They burnt, well, they did go to commentaries, but they burnt Talmuds. Okay? Therefore, for us, this is the lifeblood of oral law for us today. And next time, Be'ezrat Hashem, we will start learning a little bit of Gemara, and we will understand where we go from there. Okay? Enough.